Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast for Remainers and Brexiteers alike. Join me, Jonathan Beardmore, every week alongside Alex Davis and Christian Spence as we try and guide you through the choppy waters of Brexit. Hello and welcome to the podcast that is so good, Priti Patel listens to it in secret. This is Last Week in Brexit. As always, I am joined by Alex Davis. Hello, Alex.
Hiya.
And Christian Spence.
Hi, Jonathan.
How are we?
We're good, I think.
Yeah, good. Interesting news week.
Yeah, it has been. I mean, the big news, of course, is Alex has just got back from Rotterdam.
That is huge news.
No scandals?
No scandals whilst I was there now. It's a pretty nice place. Much more, well, more modern than you expect, I was going to say, but it's not because it was blown to smithereens.
It is entirely
modern. But much bigger and nicer than I was expecting, certainly.
Far less scandals then on this side of the channel.
Yes.
Hasn't politics been interesting for the past few days?
And I wonder if that's one of the reasons that when I've come in today, you both seem rather deflated with things.
Yeah.
Particularly when the conversation turns politics.
Well, it's an odd... I mean, we've been saying for a while politics is difficult and it's in an interesting space at the minute. But I think they're kind of the three stories. I remember ambling over to chat to our CEO yesterday afternoon and saying, can anyone remember a time when politics was in this level of a mess? Because we had essentially three major stories running yesterday. The first one, which I guess we'll come back to later, which is that... David Davis, in a written ministerial statement, uses the line that I think it's as something along the lines of, as this government has been keen to point out, the 58 Brexit sectoral impact assessments do not technically exist.
Now that's interesting. That sounds...
Let's hold that thought. We'll come back. And of course, we've currently got all of the UK news agencies literally live tracking a plane back from Africa.
I heard, at last count, there's 22,000 people tracking that plane.
Yeah, I kind of think this is one of the problems with the UK media. You know, it finally latches onto a story and then just will not let go, even when there's actually nothing to report.
But
Priti Patel is flying back from...
I think she's landed now.
Has she landed? She's here.
Are you tracking it too?
Back at 3:30.
There we go. So she's on her way to Theresa May for a dressing down because it appears that she's done quite a lot of not telling the complete truth to herself, to the Prime Minister, to the Foreign Secretary.
Maybe just to the Foreign Secretary, who knows?
Yeah, and apparently to the Israeli government as she went on what must be one of the most boring holidays in the world, where she went on a holiday to Israel and somehow managed to end up in a dozen meetings with the Israeli Prime Minister discussing whether the UK should fund the Israeli army into occupied territories.
As I understand it, wasn't it not... a hospital in the occupied territories.
It's something. It's all. I mean, I tried really not to pay too much attention to the details.
She travelled to a no-go zone, didn't she? Basically,
that's it. So these are areas that the UK doesn't even recognise as being Israeli territories. Because we don't recognise the occupied zones as being Israel. So there's all that going on. And then the other bit, Boris Johnson's implicated in that. But the other bit, of course, is there's a UK citizen currently in prison in Iran. She went out there on holiday. was arrested by the Iranian government on the basis of trying to propagate Western journalism into the country. She's maintained very clearly, and her case statement is clear, that she was not doing anything around. She was literally on holiday. Her employer has also confirmed not only that she was, you know, she's on holiday, B, she's not doing any journalism work over there, and C, they actually have no stations or work in that country because of all the international embargoes. But Boris Johnson turned up to select committee and let drop in that and say, oh yes, well of course she was out there teaching, you know, journalism and everything to all the rest. So Iran has slapped another 5-year jail sentence on her. Now, in any time previously, these two last things, and probably David Davis's, would have just resulted in instantaneous resignations or sacking.
Do you know what? There is something quite interesting to this, and I was wondering, Theresa May is clearly not in a powerful position.
No.
She has very little influence. But does this somehow make her ministers more powerful? Is this in some way benefiting the guys running the departments?
I saw someone say that so many members of the cabinet should resign that none of them will resign. Because,
yes.
Basically.
Exactly. That's it. Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. You know, it's, I mean, we talked before in, you know, on the Brexit scenario that there is no government policy on Brexit. Yeah, that's clear because the Foreign Secretary and the Trade Secretary and the Prime Minister and the Chancellor have all got very different views about how it should all pan out. This kind of stuff starts to suggest, is there any government policy at all?
Mm.
Because actually, Secretaries of State can go off and make their own things up as they go along.
See, I always think...
And there's no check from the centre.
I always think in these situations, the person with all the power isn't actually the Prime Minister. It's actually the Chancellor.
I think at this stage, when you notice he's kept himself out of a lot of this in the public eye, except for the Brexit stuff. He's keeping his powder dry. I mean, there's a huge amount of pressure on him now. If the budget is anything other than unbelievably exciting, then I think he's going to be seen as in a pretty weak position as well. But he's got very little room for manoeuvre fiscally. But we'll find that out 2 weeks today.
Yeah. It must be very disconcerting for the EU when they look across the channel and they see the goings on, particularly with the cabinet, because from their point of view, wouldn't the worst thing be if Theresa May lost power, or if a general election was actually to take place?
I think you could say so, basically because they want this thing to be wrapped up. Although I think if something did happen, it would probably change the kind of Brexit outlook quite a bit. We know that the EU has told us multiple times that extending Article 50 is still on the table. I certainly would expect that if we do end up going to a general election or something like that, that we can't just continue on the current trajectory with the current timeline. You would imagine that something would change.
Do you think, and this is completely hypothetical, it is possible that if a new general election did come about, there would be a party running on rescinding Article 50?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Lib Dems would.
Lib Dems certainly, without question. I don't think Labour can get themselves into that position, though, despite probably the fact that a majority of their benches would privately, if not publicly, support that as a mandate.
Well, there's an interesting element to this, isn't there? Because there was the debate yesterday on Article 127 and the EEA in Parliament.
Yeah.
And the debate was led by Stephen Kinnock, MP. Mm-hmm. And I haven't... I unfortunately, you know, doing this podcast right now, I haven't looked into the debate as much as I should have, or read as much as what was said as I should have. The impression that I got was that there's quite a lot of Labour backbenchers who are warming increasingly towards EEA and EFTA as a solution to this.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
And so it feels to me like if we did come to another general election, potentially Labour would position itself, you know, on a very strict soft Brexit.
And I think
strategy.
I think a lot of Conservatives would probably go along with that as well.
Yeah,
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, the time is, if you know, there's been lots of chat over the past sort of few months around is there the possibility of the emergence of a new centrist party, which essentially takes, you know, the right wing of Labour and the left wing of the Tories. I mean, you kind of think like there's no time, never again in British politics are the stars aligned in such a way that this is the most opportune moment.
Yeah. So the conundrum they would have, and they being Labour, is their leadership has no interest in the EU. And not only do they have no interest, as in, you know, they don't want to be part of it, they have no interest, i.e. they've got bigger fish to fry. You know, they want to get on with redistribution of wealth and opening, you know, national investment banks and all the rest of it. The rest of their MPs wants to desperately stay in Europe, but a lot of their voters couldn't really give them monkeys.
They either couldn't give them monkeys, or of course, you know, there's quite a large proportion of very pro-Brexit amongst their more traditional voters. So it's a huge challenge, and I think we've always maintained in this that mm-hmm. at some point this Labour fudge has to give. You know, Corbyn has managed to position the party since the campaigns to the referendum that for the pro-Brexit side he's seen as pro-Brexit, mm-hmm. and for the Leave side he's seen as pro. For the Remain side he's seen as pro-Remain. That can't go forever.
No.
Now, as long as they're in opposition, it probably can.
Yeah, because
they can just fudge it. But if there is a general election before 2019, which I've thought is increasingly probable, then they're going to have to square that circle.
But I also think if there is a general election, we'll have, I don't know how many months of, you know, election campaigning, new manifestos and things like that. I would think that there is enough time there and enough opportunity for things to change quite significantly, not just in terms of the politics that is on offer, but just in terms of the public's opinions on this stuff. I think if a general election gets called and the subject of doing Brexit completely differently or potentially not doing it at all really, really comes back onto the table, and there's lots of people really trying to make their case, and, you know, it almost becomes... It's like a new referendum lingers in the air, essentially. I really think that there's a possibility that things might change. I mean, we've seen in a lot of the polls coming out recently that people are increasingly in despair about how things are going. Lots of Leave voters, I think things are being mishandled. Many Leave voters are starting to perhaps say that maybe this is too complicated to do right now. I just think if it comes back in a big way, I think there is a chance that things could change quite drastically.
That's interesting. So, when you say it's too complicated to do now, I always have an issue with this, because if not now, when?
I guess not now, but it's too complicated to do this way, I think.
I think that's it, and that's why, and I kind of think the rescinding of Article 50 still feels very unlikely. It's a can we have an extra 2, 3, 5 years of the negotiating process? Can we push the deadline back? Because I think you've got to play to the 50. Even the country's still split basically 50-50 about whether leaving the EU is a good thing or not. So you've still got to cater to that 50% of the population. So you're still saying this is still happening. It's not that we're cancelling it, but we cannot. We just cannot do it this way. And of course, we've said since podcast one, you just can't do it this way.
I think the common thread between this podcast and podcast one is actually the lack of clarity behind the reasoning. You know, the reasoning for exiting the EU, other than to exit the EU.
Yeah, exactly. No one's answered the why, other than it's a will of the people. That's it. Yeah.
Now, some actual Brexit stuff. You alluded to it earlier on. We were talking about, last week, how you'd go about building position papers, and also the 58 position papers, which were constructed by Dexiu. What's happened to these position papers? Has anyone managed to read them yet?
Nobody has managed to read them yet. And I think the difference with how it now appears they've gone about it as the way we'd tackle it is we'd actually aim to, actually write them. Because we have an astonishing written ministerial statement from David Davis, mentioned it earlier, which essentially says the problem is, you know, we can't get them out to you very quickly. If you remember, there was a big vote in Parliament, I think pretty much as we were recording last week, which they used an arcane bit of parliamentary chicanery to essentially propose that there is a motion directly from the monarch that the Secretary of State makes available the papers to Parliament.
Sorry, run that past me again, because these things do come about occasionally on this podcast where I've just never heard of it. I've never heard of the scenario previously.
No, it's a rarely used in modern times. Apparently, it was quite regularly used in the 19th century. I can't remember its proper title, but it's essentially a motion from Parliament which requests that the head of state releases papers in the public interest. So that's what Labour managed to get through last Wednesday, which essentially makes a matter of law, essentially. Not quite law, law's not the right word, but anyway, Parliament is legally required now. The government is legally required to respond. David Davis came back and said, we take on board what you're saying, but there are things that might need to be redacted because of national security and it might jeopardise our deal making.
As in national security regarding phishing?
Yeah, exactly. Or the impact of museums and galleries on the Brexit scenario, all of that. Anyway, long story short, he came and he wrote a letter to the chair of the Dexia Select Committee, which was issued again as a written ministerial statement yesterday, which basically says, as government has been at pains to point out, although I'm not entirely sure it's taken an awful lot of pain to point this out, the 58 papers do not actually exist.
That is staggering.
So they've done work, there is analysis there, it's all been done, but it's not in a position that it's ready to be published, and they're not really 58 separate ones, and, you know, this kind of... All of a sudden, I feel like I used to feel in my first year at university.
wasn't there a paper from Dexia a couple of weeks ago which said... They went into excruciating detail.
Excruciating detail. Those are Davis's words himself.
It certainly sounds excruciating.
Yeah, that's it. But it does. It really does feel like that undergraduate sort of. Well, yes, I have done them, but you know, the dog ate some, and some are on the bus.
This is what a lot of people were saying last week: is that maybe the reason they're not releasing these things is because some work has been done, and they kind of know broadly, but they haven't written them up into fancy papers with graphs and stuff. Basically, that they're not in anywhere near a state ready to be
released. They're not the same body published, and the other words we're hearing is that actually they're there, the content's there, but it's not that good.
Yeah, it's
going to be... Not in terms of output for the UK and what it might mean, but actually just the quality of the work is not that high.
So my theory on this, because something you said earlier on, I don't know if you meant to quote it or not, but you said technically don't exist. And I start to think of Sir Humphrey in this point, which is, well, yes, of course, we do have the papers, but they don't really say what we want them to say. So maybe if they didn't exist, that would be better. I kind of think maybe that's what's going on here.
Who knows? I mean, and the question is, I don't know where we'll ever know. You know, the Davis has said within the next 2 to 3 weeks, that's what he thinks it'll take. That's the length of time it'll take his department to get them all ready, working with other departments. I mean, what is then handed over to the Select Committee in 2 or 3 weeks' time may be very, very different from what exists now. So I don't think we'll ever know. I don't think we'll ever know what's really gone on here. But the Select Committee will be getting unredacted copies. The rest of us will probably see redacted ones. But, of course, the more people it goes to in its unredacted form, the greater the chance of a leak.
Yes, exactly. Now, this is certainly, well, almost certainly a question that you're not going to know the answer to, but I'll give it a go anyway. When select committees request work from ministers from different departments, are there rules as to what should be handed over? Because what would make them have to hand over an unredacted copy? Why did they not redact it? How do they not know?
You're right, I don't know the answer in detail.
I don't know what the rules are, but I guess with things which are secret, they just have to submit a freedom of information, don't they, like everyone else?
No, because they can go beyond that. So you can have, you know, highly secret availability. Say when the CETA deal was being negotiated, ministers had to go into locked rooms with, you know, one copy on the desk, no phones allowed in, all that kind of stuff. So that does happen for top secret documents to make sure there's no leaking. So the committee could request that, and I suspect the committee will probably get unedited copies. But whether they get the copies that have already been written or whether they get reworked copies that are edited and maybe have a slightly different story.
Freedom of information is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because I saw some people on Twitter, and I can't remember what the request was for. It was Brexit related, but everything that they got back was just blacked out.
Yes.
Like, it was a freedom of information request, but literally the entire A4 page had a black square on top of it, so you couldn't read anything. I don't quite understand what the rules are.
What's the point? Yeah. So you make the request, but there are a number of exemptions in the Freedom of Information Act.
I imagine select committees have a lot more power than a simple freedom of information.
Yeah, absolutely.
Request.
Yeah.
Do we know what, for instance, and this is just me being a little bit geeky now, do we know what the punishment is or what sanctions can be taken against departments who decide not to hand over the correct information?
No idea. Absolutely no idea.
Or can they just get away with not doing it? Is it just poor form?
Yeah, I've not a clue.
You get shunned at the stranger's bar or something.
Yeah.
I suspect there's lots of poor form going on, to be honest.
Well. Well, moving away from Dexia and their non-existent papers, someone that does very much exist, Liam Fox, has come up with a statement regarding, well, something which we find very important, actually, which is rules and regulations. Can you just explain this a little bit as to what his statement may have meant?
I actually only know a specific snippet of it, which got picked out. What was the statement actually based on?
He was, I believe, he was speaking in front of Parliament, and he said something along the lines of he wants to move away from the system of regulation and laws from the EU.
Yeah, it was that we would prefer an equivalence model, to move towards an equivalence model from the EU's harmonisation model. And it's not quite, it's not particularly clear what that means, but I think what it means is that instead of us in the future continuing to automatically align ourselves with the rules and regs of the single market, for example, you know, like Norway do. So when the single market changes its rules and regs, but they are basically, once ratified, they are automatically applied to EEA countries. What he's suggesting is that we can instead set up a system of equivalence so that we can diverge our rules and regs away from those of the single market, but a system is maintained which allows trade to continue as frictionlessly as possible. Get my mouth around that. which is something we've talked about quite a lot before, this whole idea of convergence versus divergence post-Brexit. And it seems to me like this is another have your cake and eat it type ordeal where we want to do our own thing, but we don't want the borders to be have strict checks imposed.
Well, it sounds perfectly reasonable what he's suggesting. It just doesn't sound perfectly practical. I don't see what the point would be.
No, and that's it. I mean, I think this comes back to something we sort of dwelt on a bit more in the past sort of 2-3 weeks here, sort of thinking about this stuff, is there's a huge challenge, because most people in the UK, and certainly probably most businesses actually, because so much of their trade or their own movement on holidays or whatever is with Europe, they assume that the way borders work between the UK and Europe is kind of the norm. And it's not. It's really odd. Europe is a lone partner, a lone state in the world in the way that it's developed a single market and a customs union and all that kind of stuff. And so this is the idea that they say, oh, well, we want frictionless borders because we've got those now, but we want to make our own regs, or we want to have a slightly looser relationship, without kind of getting to the core point, which is it's not having a loose relationship with Europe. It's having an incredibly tight relationship with Europe, which enables the frictionless border.
Yes.
They are two sides of the same coin. You can't say you want a frictionless border and a divergence. It just cannot happen in any legal state. The EU will defend the integrity of its single market to its own death, I suspect, quite honestly. And it has international obligations as well, which means it has to do that. So the challenge is essentially, as soon as we start to allow, agriculture, foodstuffs or anything else into the UK which doesn't meet EU regs, that's the point at which the border starts to get tighter. Because essentially the EU has to guarantee that those products which don't meet their regulations are not coming over their border and into Europe. You can't use us as a backdoor into the EU. And that's the challenge. And it just feels like, still, 18 months into this, and for people like David Oates and Liam Fox, 30 years into their crusade against the EU, they've still not got this unbelievably simple concept.
Yeah, it's totally unclear whether Liam Fox made that point very specifically and was briefed and say, use these words before, or whether he just doesn't quite have a grasp at the moment.
See, this is the part which I have an issue with.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine either these gentlemen don't have a grasp on it. I simply can't come to that conclusion.
I know what you mean, and the person I've most had this kind of sort of issue with recently is, conveniently, his name is immediately fallen out of my head as soon as I need to say it, John Redwood.
Yeah, yes, there's no way he does not know.
John Redwood is by virtue of his history, I've seen his speeches when he was a minister himself, in his business career previously, in the writings, whether you agree with his positions on things, he's clearly an intelligent man.
Yeah. Same with Rees-Mogg, same with Hannan.
But what you find on this, what you find when you start getting into the detail of Brexit with them, is they either know they're lying or they're being willfully stupid. Because there's no way that someone of that intellectual calibre is making these mistakes repeatedly, despite having been really clearly corrected and pointed directly to the body of evidence which proves that what they're saying is not true. And so I don't know. It's about how, it's the whole thing, isn't it? How do you have an intellectual debate with someone who's willfully thick?
But the thing is, being a dishonest actor.
Yeah, because you just can't make progress.
Yeah.
Sorry, Alec.
I was going to say, you think that these, like, they must have a grasp on this stuff, right? But, I mean, it is complicated stuff. And, for example, there was a BBC reality check this week talking specifically about the whole John Redwood thing. You know, we can revert to WTO terms because we trade with the rest of the world on WTO terms. The rest of the world trades on those terms, blah, 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 blah. And the BBC did a reality check thing, which is meant to be where their researchers go away and come back with, you know, falsifications or myth-busting. And they came back to say that the EU currently has trade deals with, I think, 68 countries now. Mm-hmm. There are 24 countries with which the EU trades on WTO terms. And these include, and it said, the USA and China, you know, and all the usual examples. And that's not true. And so lots of people sent some things to the BBC saying, that's not correct, because we do have multiple trade deals with America, for example. I actually think if you stack up the bilaterals and multilaterals between the EU and the USA, they outnumber the country in second position by double, I think. We have lots of agreements with the USA. And so it's not true that we trade with those on WTO terms. And so they issued a redaction and a change to the reality check verdict, which then just said, in terms of tariffs, we trade with 24 countries on WTO terms. And again, that's technically correct, but it's kind of missing the point, because exactly. if you're looking to bust the myth that, like, people like John Redwood are peddling, that's not how to do it, because that's technically true, but that leads people to believe that we don't need trade deals with those places in order for things to stay as they are. And it's kind of, they've kind of done the myth busting, but they've totally missed the point in doing it. And so if the BBC and its team of researchers can be doing stuff like that still, maybe people like John Redwood still have got this wrong.
Give me your version. Give me your best version, your most sincere version of John Redwood's argument that he would be happy with and you could live with.
Summarise what his argument is, actually.
Yeah, but in a way that, I mean, I simply don't believe everything that he says is false. So give me a version of
you're right. The challenge is not that everything he says is false, but it's not a complete picture.
And
I think one of the podcasts we've done before kind of dives into this in a lot of detail, where we talk about, actually, it's because this is an incredibly complex area, complex area, of which, you know, not somebody been denigrating, and I include myself in this, you know, 99% of the country know less than 3/5 of nothing about this topic. And despite, you know, I think both probably Alex and I would admit, having done this for 18 months in detail, we still barely scrape the surface of the kind of specialist knowledge that this is required. But Redwood's point is kind of twofold. One is, most of the rest of the world trades with most of the rest of the world on WTO terms. Mm-hmm. Which, in terms of preferential trade agreements, is correct. Most of the world, I'd say most of the world, not what shares, but, you know, the EU trades with the US without a preferential trade agreement. That is correct. Mm-hmm. He also says that because the EU has a trade deficit, we have a trade deficit with the EU, we don't need to worry, because they wouldn't want to impose tariffs on us anyway, because they would be hurt, their consumers would be hurt more than our producers, because they buy more from us than we buy from them. Which, well, it's true that we run a trade deficit, but phrases like, they wouldn't want to impose tariffs. Well, the point is, the UK walking out of the EU leaves the EU with no choice under international law but to impose its common external tariff on the UK. It must do so as part to keep its definition of a customs union intact at a global regulation level. Mm-hmm. It is also required to do it as under part of its WTO terms under most favoured nation. So the EU is not choosing to do anything. And this is actually kind of a crucial bit for me, which the UK negotiating side misses. It's the UK has chosen to leave. And that's the EU's position in all of this. You know, the EU is not imposing anything on the UK. Those very carefully worded statements of Michel Barnier, which said the UK has, as its sovereign right, decided to leave the UK, and we will not stand in the way of, to leave the EU, and we will not stand in the way of it. Now that has implications. Without a trade deal, a preferential free trade agreement in place, the EU will have to impose its common external tariff on the UK. It has absolutely no choice. It would throw so many defaults would be thrown up by WTO members if it didn't. It would just be carnage. So those things that he says that aren't necessarily untrue, but they're not, they have a complete picture. So the WTO, the US trades with the EU without a preferential trade deal. Correct. But it does use 60-odd bilateral, maybe more actually.
124
bilateral agreements.
Narrow areas of industry.
So yeah, so trade facilitation, or trade facilitation, or customs agreements, custom facilitation agreements, or mutual recognition for certain aspects. But that's 64 different bilaterals with one country. And I think, isn't it? Yeah, you, I've just seen you googling a country, and that was the other thing I was gonna, gonna come to next.
It made me think of it, a blog post which I read. So, we've said before there are multiple types of trade agreements. There are preferential trade agreements. There are regional trade agreements. There are individual bilaterals on specific product sectors. Blah blah blah. All of them have to be registered with the WTO. So you can go onto the WTO website, and you can actually bring up a map of, you know, you can put in EU, you can put in regional trade agreements, and it'll show you a map with lines going to all the countries with which the EU has regional trade agreements. You can do this to it for every country that is a member of the WTO in its own right. And so a guy wrote some computer code which would go through the WTO website for every member and scrape all their trade deals that they had to find if any countries around the world traded just on WTO terms, which is kind of what is implied by the things that Redwood and Rees-Mogg say. And it turns out that there is one country, in the world which trades solely on WTO terms and has no deals whatsoever, and it is the Islamic Republic of Mauritania.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I'll just quickly Wikipedia-ing it whilst Christian.
GDP.
GDP is about, what does it say, 5 billion.
5 billion, so about one tenth the size of Greater Manchester.
Yes, and 4% of the population are slaves.
Well, okay. Well, Rome wasn't built in a day. I think the valid point in the Redwood, Hanan, Rees-Mogg argument, right, is if the regulation of selling soap is that intense, is it really something that we need to be indulging in? And I think that's kind of the angle that the. I mean, it's a rather broader point which hasn't really caught much traction. But that's what I would say that they're talking about. Just the reinstitution of free trade in the true sense of the word.
Yeah, I think we've been over this loads of times, but it strikes me as just kind of an old-fashioned view of trade. Mm. I mean, because if these regulations are so unnecessary and it'd be so much cheaper to do trade without them, then they wouldn't be there, or we just trade with places where they don't exist. The benefits that they bring in terms of making trade easier must outweigh the cost of them in terms of the financial costs.
Yeah.
And we
keep coming back to the point, tariffs are important, but they're increasingly less important.
Yes,
WTO rounds, the Doha rounds, are removing tariffs rapidly.
So I do wonder if it would be worth doing the Doha rounds and all the rest of it. To remove regulation rather than to remove tariffs. I mean, that would be my personal.
Well, and that's partly where it's going. And actually, this is what the EU is seen as the absolute global leader in doing. It's alignment of regulation.
Alignment isn't the same as reduction, though.
No,
that's quite important.
No, it may be important. It may not. It'll be important in some areas. It'll be important to you in ways it's not important to me, and vice versa, and cross sector and cross country. But the thing which allows trade to happen really easily is alignment. I think it's one of the very first slides you did for the Brexit presentations before. If you're not talking regulation, you're not talking trade. That is, this world of finished manufactured goods popping out of a factory in country A and going to country B is a tiny, tiny share of global trade now, and particularly in the way that the UK sits within the EU. We don't make finished goods and send them to the EU. Yeah. We do a bit, send them to somebody else. They do a bit, bits come back. You can't have any customs checks in the middle of those because it disrupts the whole concept of just-in-time manufacturing, and it goes against why those supply chains have emerged where they are. So if you want that to be frictionless, you've got to agree the same regulation.
Well, talking about agreeing things, I do believe some news. Well, it's something that you posted, Alex, that the citizens' rights stuff, which we thought was agreed, has now not been agreed or been unagreed, if there is such a thing. The bill seems to be more or less agreed at about 60 billion, but trade talks will not start now, they don't think, until January. Is that correct? Is that the timetable that we're looking at?
This was a thread which was posted by a guy called Jonathan Liss.
That's right.
He works for British Influence. And it was quite a scary thread. Lots of people have come back and said, you know, we're not quite sure that things are this bad. But essentially he's been over to Brussels and has given us a view from Brussels. And the reason he was so pessimistic was that primarily because there seems to be a level of optimism here that talks will move on to trade in December. And apparently there is no optimism for that on the other side, and that they don't expect that we'll move on to trade talks until, you know, at least Q1 next year. But that gives us potentially only 7 or 8 months to do everything, you know, in terms of trade, which would be a massive, massive problem. It's not possible. They basically just say it's not possible. So there's much less confidence on the other side. And it is down to things like, again, the citizens' rights. There was a new paper published on citizens' rights this week, which just before I came over here to do the podcast, the EU Parliament sent a response back saying, again, it's not good enough. That was led up by Guy Verhofstadt again. Again, outlining a number of areas where we're closer, but we're still far away kind of thing, saying that not enough progress has been made. And then the other one was on the divorce bill, where I think the number has been broadly agreed, that it's about 60 billion. I just don't think the EU has got what it wants in terms of our specific commitments and the methodology by which this will be paid.
Well, there's no methodology, is there? I
think currently we've just plucked a number out of thin air. We keep increasing it in the hope it'll help move forward, but it's not
10 billion more?
It doesn't really appear to... Yeah, we talked about this before. This is not, from our point of view, what the EU's looking for.
Yeah, I do wonder if the methodology has been agreed on the British side and the number is so vast that we just keep on throwing out, you know, an extra 10 billion until they agree with it.
Yeah. I don't know, but this thread was... It didn't make things sound great. He ended on, you know, what he said was the good news was that apparently it's been constantly reiterated over there that we can extend Article 50 if we want to. And that was his particular position, is that that's the only way that we get out of this. At this point anyway, is that we extend Article 50 by, you know, 2 or 3 years to give us more time to figure out how to do it. And that was his piece of good news on the end. But then there were lots of people coming back and saying, you know, we're so critical of... On our side of this idea that a narrative is being spun, you know, over and above what actually might be going on. So a narrative is being spun, you know, around our negotiating tactics. You know, we're saying one thing whilst we're obviously meaning another, and that maybe people are being a little bit too uncritical of the other side, and that maybe the EU are also spinning a narrative.
No, I completely agree with that.
Yeah. It's a difficult one. I mean, a journalist can present things however he wants, I suppose.
Yes, and it depends on, you know, the position of the journalist too, but I do think that the big advantage that the EU has is it's simply unaccountable. One of the reasons that, you know, Britain voted to leave is because it's unaccountable, and one of the reasons it's so hard to negotiate with is because it's unaccountable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, that all stacks up rather nicely. Is there anything else you gents want to talk about regarding this week?
I'm not sure
not
there is this week, because it's the Brexit. I mean, we've got, you know, we'll have stuff to talk about because the next round of negotiations with the EU starts tomorrow. So we know we'll have.
And there are only 2 days.
It's only 2 days. Don't know why.
Why?
But I mean, this is something where I think the EU's dragging its foot, because apparently, and it is only apparently, I've not seen a formal document from the UK government. Yeah. But apparently, we're saying, look, why can't we move into continuous talks? I think that's a very good question.
That is a good
which
question.
The EU hasn't really answered yet. So I don't understand it. You know, this is apparently the most critical thing for both parties, but we're messing around meeting up for, you know, 2 afternoons once every 5 weeks.
I have to guess it's probably the work time directive.
So I don't know. So we'll know more next week. But no, for the minute, it's all a bit quiet, unless you're desperate to know what's happening to the Secretary of State for the Department for International Development.
Yeah.
Is anyone on the news? Do we
know? I have Twitter open in front of me, but there's nothing on this screen, and I kind of fear that. Feel so that it could, once it happens,
there could be lots to talk about on the next podcast.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Well, I mean, the general election will have kicked off by now.
Who knows? Yes.
Right. Well, let's wrap this up then. Is there anything going on in the Chamber of Commerce this week?
I would have thought so. There usually is, but I'm just knee deep in lots of research work at the minute.
And if you want to find you guys on Twitter, where do we go?
Our usual place for me at gmcc_Christian.
I'm at gmcc_Alex.
And if for whatever reason you'd ever want to get hold of me, It's at Jay Beardmore. So in a week where everyone is talking about tax avoidance, just remember, Bulgaria has a flat rate of 10%. I shall leave you with that thought, and until next week, goodbye. Flat rate of
10%. 1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.